Thank you. Thank you, David. I'm going to like switch my screen back to gallery mode so I can see all of you. It's a real pleasure to have an opportunity to share space with this sangha that I admire greatly over the years. And I was very much looking forward to visiting the center again and speaking your beautiful hall. And so maybe it will be another time. And like David said, I have to say I was falling asleep at 7:45, 3 hours ago. So I took the drastic measure of taking a nap after dinner to ensure that I can be awake, because last night I was completely asleep by 9:45. So if you saw my beginning to get incoherent, that I'm going to blame it on that. So thank you for joining me this evening. And I spoke with David, a dear friend from the Gen X community, and he gave me this list of a big wish list of what he would like me to talk about, and then I discovered the amount of time I got, so I would do my best. What he told me is well, I think it's really a good request that since you haven't met me, you probably want to know who is it who is speaking. And I also heard that it would be there would be great interest to hear something about how it was to train with Master Shen Yan and perhaps how he trained students. And so I hope in what I'm going to talk about, it will address that. And so depending on how time goes, I have a giant clock in front of me so I don't go over time. I hope to be able to share a little bit of what's alive for me, what's of great interest to me in the recent days. And one thing that might be helpful to talk about is I often find there are a great deal of assumption made about me because of my ancestry. For example, people assume that I grew up Buddhist, which is not very close to truth at all. I grew up in a totally non-religious family. My parents are quite confused still why they had a Buddhist daughter and an evangelical Christian brother. And so a son. And I was born and grew up in a British colony, Hong Kong. And because of that, I received a British education and rather very often a non-Chinese upbringing because of my environment and because of the fact that my parent had to move to Hong Kong and start their life anew when they had to flee communist China. So, and I ended up in the United States when I went to California to do my graduate study in sociology. It was in California where I encountered Master Shen Yan's teaching through my current husband. That's another assumption often made. He was a genetics graduate student, a blue-eyed white guy from Kansas. So most people just assume that I made him Buddhist, but it was the other way around. He already practiced Zen for a number of years, and at that time he was studying with a student of Master Shen Yan in California, Southern California. And he was actually the person who taught me how to meditate. And so that was another common assumption. Usually people just like look super surprised when they heard that. And At that time, that's before Google and all that stuff, so I actually had to go to a monastery in the LA area to borrow actual paper books written by Master Shen Yan to I felt a very strong affinity with him after I read his books. In particular, I remember one of the very first book I read by him. He wrote about what Buddhism is about, which is very different from the folk understanding for people among whom I grew up with, and really resonated with me. It felt very much like what I was looking for and really made a lot of sense to me. And so what happened was, a few months later, he made a trip to Los Angeles, a rare occasion, and I took refuge with him the very first time I saw him in person after he gave a public lecture. And that was before I had a chance to practice with him in a retreat. And it was very difficult to get into a retreat with him that he held in his center in Queens, New York. So almost a year later, I finally had a chance to travel from Southern California to Queens to attend the first retreat, which was a 7-day intensive retreat in Queens. And I feel like when I first met him in the interview in that retreat, I remember that I just felt like I found my teacher, and I couldn't stop praying. I didn't quite know why, but I felt that I finally found him. And so it started the years of my life in the final years of my graduate study, where I worked on my research but also devoted a great deal of time and energy to my practice, prioritizing my practice. So when it was time for me to go on a job market, being able to practice, preferably being to be close to Master Shen Yan, was important. And that's how I ended up in New Jersey, and I took an academic position here. Because I was living in New Jersey, I traveled to the center every weekend when I was here on my own, because at that time my then fiance was still finishing his graduate study. And what happened was a series of interesting events over the first 10 years when I was living in New Jersey. I became his interpreter because his interpreter at that time had to take a leave, and I was asked to be trained to be his interpreter. And I tried because I didn't really understand Mandarin, which was what Master Shen Yan was speaking in. I could only understand his Dharma talks in translation in English. And I became his interpreter in his Dharma talks and retreats, and I traveled with him internationally when he was attending religious leaders' meetings. And looking back, part of what drove me was when I was staying at the center over those weekends, inevitably every morning we would share breakfast. We actually share all the meals. Every time when Master Shen Yan returned from Taiwan, he split his time between Taiwan and New York. He would ask how we could bring Chan practice into American society more, in a more integrated way. And the Sangha was struggling. That by that time, it was mostly supported and attended by, I think, mostly Taiwanese immigrants. And so the community was struggling with that a little bit. And in my mind, I told myself I would do everything I could to help him with that. And so when they wanted me to be his interpreter, that's what I thought I could do, the small part I could do. And around the same time, someone approached Master Shen Yan to publish or work on an autobiography for him, which was eventually published in the title of Footprint in the Snow. Some of you might have read it, and we didn't know, but it turned out to be a 10-year project. And it was one of the greatest blessings of my life to be the one person who helped work on that project. And so with working on that project, one thing it involved me having to conduct a lot of interviews with Master Shen Yan. And what Master Shen Yan said was that, well, I don't have any time to do this. The only time I could do interviews for this book was during retreats. So from then on, during every intensive retreat I attended with Master Shen Yan, I served as his interpreter during the retreat talks, and also I would spend an hour of each day conducting interview with him for his book. And I also did help with some organizational things, such as helping to coordinate the teacher's training. I was also drafted, asked to participate in a teacher training program, largely because he got tired of people just sitting in his Dhamma talks and then not do anything with what he talked about. So he wanted us to train to be possibly become lecturer in the Dhamma, and as a way, and really his trick to get us to study the Dhamma more diligently. And so that's something I did, and that resulted in my starting to teach as a Dhamma lecturer in 2002. And of course that compelled me to take my Dhamma study more seriously so that I could talk about a Dhamma in a way that would be helpful for others. And looking back, I saw that going through that training and being a Dhamma lecturer was a very important part of my training in the Dhamma. It compelled me to practice more diligently than I would otherwise. I was also drafted to help with running the retreat center in 2004. At that time, the organization wanted to engage in some restructuring. So Dhamma Dharma Retreat Center was trying to incorporate as a separate organization, and I was asked to be one of its founding board members and try to figure out how to set things up there. And it was quite a learning experience to learn to navigate the delicate situation of teasing out that part of the organization from the existing community without damaging relationships. It was a real project and a great gift that Master Shen Yan gave to me in my training over the years. I think I for over 15 years I was doing that work. And I also trained with Master Shen Yan's two most senior lay Dhamma heirs from the UK, Dr. John Crook and Simon Chow, from whom I received my Dhamma transmission. And it was very interesting. What happened was Master Shen Yan tasked them and his Dhamma heirs, but in particular John Crook, Master Shen Yan tasked them with the job of adapting Chan practice to the West. Because when John Crook, the first Dharma heir, received his transmission, he asked Master Shen Yin, what should I do? And Master Shen Yin told him, well, I'm not a Westerner. You go figure it out. And that's I kept that in mind because Master Shen Yin entrusted him to find his way and to as a way to fulfill his great vow of sharing this great gift of Buddha Dharma to as many people as possible. And my training would not be complete without mentioning what I've learned from John Crook and Simon Chow. So I don't know, many of you may not have heard of him. He's a good friend of David Lloyd and Stephen Batchelor in the UK, and he had skillfully incorporated Western psychology and encounter group techniques he picked up while he was a visiting professor at Stanford. And the way he did it helped practitioners develop this mind of inquiry, which is actually quite tricky to do. And I would argue that he has done a brilliant job to accomplish them. For the practitioners that I trained with, that I later teach, they learn to penetrate the mind using a question. He designed this retreat called Western Zen Retreat, which uses a question and similar to the practice of Huato. Some of you might have heard of that in Chinese Chan, but in a different way from how it was done in traditional Chan practice. But it's very, very effective. And from my experience over the years, practitioners who have attended the Western Zen Retreat, who have trained with this kind of method, are much better at picking up the practice of cultivating clear awareness, such as even in a silent illumination retreat, without falling into the trap of quietism. And I have benefited greatly from training with them. And so as a result, I largely teach along this line, and it has yielded very much benefits. And I believe it is an approach that suits the Western educated mind. So I think for many of us, whether we are what we call Westerners or not, nowadays, even in Asia, all my friends are at Western educated, and find that they could connect with this kind of approach more readily than the much more traditional Chinese method. And I think, I don't know how much you know about Master Shen Yin. In the United States, he's mostly known as a Chan master. But he's also a very accomplished Buddhist scholar. He pursues scholarship in Buddhism, not with an eye to become a knowledgeable scholar person, but as a way to practice and also to really revive Chinese Buddhism for the benefit of the world. Because he deeply believed that the way Buddhism had developed in China had resulted in a form of practice and teaching that makes it very portable from culture to culture. And so what he did was he engaged in a 6-year solitary retreat in which he engaged in intensive practice, but also read through all the Tripitaka, or so he was not well versed only in Chan part of Buddhism, but all of Agamas, or the early early Buddhist teaching, but also other traditions, Tiantai, Huayan, all of it. And he also went to graduate study in Japan, so he also became familiar with Japanese Buddhism and various form of Japanese Buddhist practice, which brought him to be a very eclectic teacher. So in terms of techniques, he picked up many different forms of practice and incorporated them wherever he find they are useful. So for example, when he first started teaching meditation in New York, that was when he first started teaching, he asked what did people like to do? And he heard, oh yeah, people really like to counter breath. So that's what he taught. And of course he was familiar with that from his study of Tiantai. When there was not a traditional method in meditation in Chan. For a Chan monastery, up to that point in most of the early 20th century, or of course even before, the method used to calm the monks actually reciting the Buddha's name, and what we will associate with the Pure Land method. So I thought I will give you a little bit of a sense of the other side of Master Shen Yan that might not be well known. But the reason is that his scholarly work led him to view Chan in a way that might be quite different from others. And I remember from the very first retreat I attended with him, he kept saying this thing about how Zen or Chan is Buddha Dharma, which I didn't quite understand why he kept saying it. And later on I heard that some people thought that Zen or Chan is something, is its own thing. And as I study his scholarly work more, he really wanted to clarify that Chan is not just a sect in Buddhism. Chan practice is a culmination of centuries of Buddhist practice and study in China that was later also spread to Japan, Korea, and other parts of Asia. And that was Buddhism inherited from India. And so it was all of Buddha Dharma. And so when we practice Chan, we are practicing the Buddha's teaching. And he focused on the practice of Hua Tou and silent illumination. And with silent illumination being particularly portable, because intensive Hua Tou retreat can be done really mainly in an intensive retreat setting where practitioners are well supported, whereas silent illumination is a practice that can be done anywhere, whatever you do. And so that's that part of it. And I want to talk a little bit about, it sounds like I've just been talking about my story, but I want to talk about Master Shen Yan's approach in teaching and training his student. You can, if you're listening, you're like, I don't, where's the training program? I don't see Rebecca went through any real training program there. There was no set program. And the way he trained his students, my experience is unique. No one else did the exact list of things I did, but the training I went through is actually not atypical among Master Shengyan students, which is very much an emphasis on Bodhisattva path, where we prioritize engaging in the practice that bring benefits to others. And that's the practice of sitting meditation, mainly to stabilize the mind so that we can cultivate insights, but not to engage in meditation for deep meditative experiences. And so when I say emphasizing this Bodhisattva path, very often is done by engaging in various kind of what we call work practice. As you can see, if you remember the different things that I was asked to do, I was not asked to do more longer retreats. And very often in retreats, I had assignments during retreats. And for almost every retreat, I would have some practitioners in the retreats who came up to me and almost feeling sorry for me, that like, Rebecca, I feel so sorry for you. You didn't get to like sit as much as we do because you have to talk as the translator, and you seem to have to leave the Chan Hall because you have to, I don't know what you have to go do, which is when I went to do the interview. And because of what I had to do, I had to focus on my practice even more than if I was sitting on my cushion. So for example, because I had to translate for Master Shengyan, I remember when I was doing sitting meditation, I really could not goof around in my sitting meditation. I had to, I told myself, I better really practice well so that my mind can be clear, so that I could understand Master Shengyan's lecture, so that I could translate all of them to those in attendance, because otherwise they would miss out on what he was teaching. And it was not uncommon for him to talk 15-20 minutes at a time for before I get to translate for him. So because of that, I was motivated to be more concentrated, to stabilize my mind, get into the retreat right away. And of course, to be his translator, I also need to study and learn the Dhamma terms and the content itself, and besides learning Mandarin. And because he spoke with a very heavy accent, I learned to listen every word very, very closely. So it was, I learned to develop a listening skill. So this is an example of what I was talking about by practicing the Bodhisattva path, which we engage in some work with some people. We think it feels like a chore or work, but because the goal or the motivation was to do this to help others to be able to practice, then it actually became a vehicle to deepen our own practice. And similar experience can be found in my work of interviewing for his books. And for one thing, I had to let go of the attachment that I'm here for a retreat and I should be sitting in meditation. During those interviews, that's how I practice. I practice listening to the interview and typing them all down in front of a computer. Many people would not think of that as right thing that one should be doing in a chant retreat. But that's very much part of the practice. So I learned not to be attached to the form of practice. Of course, being able to listen to Master Xing Yan talk about his life story was incredibly invaluable. I learned so much from him, from his example, how he respond and lived his life. For example, when he had to flee to Taiwan in 1949 when the Chinese Communist Party took over China, because of the fear that the communists would force monastics to disrobe. So he fled, but he, you know, the only way for him to flee was to join the nationalist military. So he ended up as a military, so he had to leave monastic life for 10 years. So for other people, they might feel very discouraged, but he made the best of it and took advantage of the vacation time to visit with old masters who also fled to Taiwan, and also and focus on finding ways for himself to resume monastic life, and it was the determination and great vow that deepened his resolve and commitment. And so I learned from these story, and I draw on them all the time as I encounter challenges as a Dharma teacher, and also as I, for example, during the years when I had to set things up and establish a retreat center for Dharma Drum, and also currently as I'm establishing my own Sangha after I received my Dharma transmission from Simon Child. So time really flies when you talk, and I really would like to give some time for a question. I guess I would share something quickly that it's been really been on my mind. When I went to recently, I've been practicing with this sutra that was brought to my attention by my dear friend Brother Fa Pai, senior disciple of Thich Nhat Hanh. This is the sutra on the eight realizations of the great beings. I started integrating them into my morning service during my solitary retreat in Hong Kong. And if you have not encountered this sutra, I encourage you to read it. It's a very short sutra. It pretty much sums up what we should remember all the time as a practitioner. And it's talked about eight realizations, but the one I want to bring to your attention, because when I read it, I was like, wow, the Buddha and these great practitioners were talking about it centuries ago. This is the second oldest sutra brought into China. So it's the second sutra that was translated into Chinese for Chinese Buddhists. And I want to read the text of this realization. The sixth realization is the awareness that poverty creates hatred and anger, which creates a vicious cycle of negative thoughts and activity. When practicing generosity, bodhisattvas consider everyone, friends and enemies alike, as equal. They do not condemn anyone's past wrongdoing, nor do they hate those who are presently causing harm. When I read this, I said, this is so useful for us in dealing with the current political situation in our country. Here, it's like this realization is the awareness, remembering that poverty creates hatred and anger. Remembering that here poverty, of course, is not just referring to material poverty. It can be poverty or in rights and status, power. So really, he's this is talking about being aware and remembering that being marginalized and treated unfairly will breed anger and hatred. And we should remember it all the time so that we will not turn a blind eye to social structure that breeds or allow unfair treatment of some part of the population. But I believe that's not what's been happening. We allow that. We allow inequality to grow, injustices to fester, and pretend that we can get away with it. And so remembering it, being aware of it, will really is to remind us not to tolerate it, not to tolerate extreme inequality and injustice and foolish belief that it's not going to become a problem. And here is talking about the practice of generosity. And I was so moved when I read about this. It's not just about generosity at the personal level, but it also remind us of how we really need to reflect on the destructiveness of the politics of meanness that we have been practicing in our society, and really look deeply into how we can change the way we deal with politics, so we don't perpetuate this idea there are some people in our society that don't deserve a life with basic human dignity. But the last sentence I think is quite very, very important, that we do not condemn anyone's past wrongdoing. Unfortunately, that is our habit, whether it's the discussion of racial injustice or other kind of inequality or climate change. We are ready to condemn those who have done wrong in the past, and making it very difficult to have a conversation, to find solution together. And in the Buddha's time and his disciples, they already discovered this and left it in writing for us to guide us not to condemn others' past wrongdoing. And in fact, if we practice and look into our own past, we know we have made a lot of mistakes out of ignorance, out of foolishness, a lack of awareness. And so we can remember that same applies to others. And nor do they hate those who are presently causing harm. Again, it is an important reminder. There are those who are causing harm. We don't condone that. We need to hold them accountable. But it's not out of hatred. It's out of compassion to stop them from creating more unwholesome karma for themselves, to stop them from hurting more people. But it's not because we hate them. And of course, generating hatred in our hearts towards them only hurt ourselves, and it's not going to help matter to progress. So this reminds me of two lines that Master Shen Yin articulated that I use all the time. That with wisdom, there's no vexation. With compassion, there's no enemy. So when we practice this way, the most difficult problem can be sorted out and resolved in our lives. So I will let you do the closing now. Thank you.
Great, thank you so much. Let's transition by offering the closing chant, which you'll find in the chat, and we have time for may our intention be extended to every being and place with the true merit of God's way. Beings are numberless, I vow to save them. Illusions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless, I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable, I vow to become. So, I'd like to recognize that we're at our usual ending time. It would be very nice to